Radio 3, it's midday and time for the news, read by Andrew Peach.
The Gambling Commission is reportedly looking into allegations that a fourth senior Conservative official placed bets on the timing of the general election. The Sunday Times has named him as Nick Mason, the party's chief data officer. He's told the paper he denies any wrongdoing. Labour said the latest allegations were utterly extraordinary and called on Rishi Sunak to suspend anyone implicated. A parliamentary aide to the Home Secretary has described the government's plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda as crap. James Sunderland, who's a Conservative candidate in the election, was recorded expressing his view at a private event in April. He went on to defend the plan, saying it would deter migrants from crossing the Channel. In an interview with the BBC, the Home Secretary, James Cleverly, suggested that Mr Sunderland had used the word for dramatic effect and was in fact supportive of the policy. A significant number of flights from Manchester Airport have been delayed or cancelled after a major power cut. The airport said the widespread disruption was particularly affecting departures from terminals 1 and 2. It advised passengers due to travel from those terminals not to go to the airport and to contact their airlines for the latest information. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has attempted to defuse a row with the United States over what he's described as delays in US weapons shipments. US officials have expressed disappointment and bewilderment after Mr. Netanyahu accused Washington of withholding weapons and ammunition for about 4 months. Today, Mr. Netanyahu told his cabinet the issue would be resolved, as he put it, in the near future. Ukraine's Navy has published satellite images which it says show the destruction of a Russian warehouse and training infrastructure used to launch Iranian-designed explosive drones. It said the attack took place on Friday in Krasnodar in southwestern Russia and was a joint operation with Ukraine's security service. The weather, a band of cloud lingering across parts of Wales, the Midlands and parts of southern England today. There will be some brighter spells at times. A fine day elsewhere with some sunshine. Top temperatures of 24 in London, 22 in Cardiff, 20 in Edinburgh and Belfast. And that's the BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12. Now on Radio 3, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Olivia Lang has won prizes and critical acclaim for her books, but readily admits that she led quite a wild life before becoming a writer. She dropped out of university, lived in a treehouse on an anti-road protest, and later trained and worked as a herbalist. Her non-fiction books include The Trip to Echo Spring, which examined how writers who were damagingly addicted to alcohol could still produce great literature. She drew on her own experience of extreme loneliness in New York to write The Lonely City, which blended memoir with reflections on the works of artists including Edward Hopper and Andy Warhol. Most recently, she's written The Garden Against Time, and it's an account of how she's restoring a walled garden in Suffolk and an investigation into the history of gardens and the solace and the pleasure that they can bring. We're going to hear, Olivia, a profusion of music today, including Puccini, Purcell, Wagner. But we're going to start with some Bach, which I think for you has a connection with the natural world.
It absolutely does. I first heard this piece driving at night in Scotland. We were very far north, up past Ullapool, and we were on a very small road, passing locks that you couldn't see, but you could sort of feel, and very wild countryside. And the person I was with put this on and said, "This is very beautiful, you're going to love it." And as the violins began to converse with each other, deer just started flooding across the road, a great herd of deer, and they kept coming and coming. And it was probably one of the most sublime moments of musical listening in my whole life.
There's a wonderful entwining going on, almost foliage or people, tendrils you can see touching and caressing.
And it has this sort of longing, yearning quality, but there's also something very stoical and stately and formal. It's inside its bounds and full of feeling. It's so beautiful.
Nowadays, most people would do this on period instruments. And this is a more kind of romantic version. Do you have any feelings about that? And is there an analogy with what's fashionable in gardening?
What's fashionable in gardening right now is so much about rewilding, letting things do what they want. And I think the kind of gardening I'm interested in is really poised between that and something slightly more formal. I'm interested in artistry and wildness meeting. Perhaps that's why I like that piece of music so much, that it feels like it's just very gently balanced on this pivot between two different places.
Structure but freedom.
Absolutely. That's what I'm seeking.
Largo Manon Tanto. That's the slow movement from Bach's Concerto for Two Violins in D minor, performed and directed by Yehudi Menuhin, with Christian Ferrar playing the second violin, and the Bath Festival Orchestra. Your early life, Olivia, really began in Chalfont St Peter in Buckinghamshire, didn't it?
It did. Just outside the M25.
Your mum was a freelance journalist?
Yes.
And your father?
My father was an investment analyst, but he left when I was four. So it was really my mother and her partner. She was in a relationship with a woman. So that was the atmosphere of my growing up, to be a very different kind of family to the home county's environment in which we found ourselves.
Were you very aware that it was different?
Absolutely. At that time, I was at a convent school. My mother is Irish and from a Catholic family, and it was very traditional. Lovely school, which I loved going to, very gentle. But there was a strong sense that there was a difference in our household, a kind of secrecy, a necessary secrecy, and a sort of tension around that as well.
Because things have changed since then, but at that point, not that it was
changed
that long ago, but
they have changed so utterly and dramatically that I feel like younger listeners won't believe the sort of corrosive atmosphere of homophobia at the time. And my early childhood is before Section 28, but once Section 28 passed, it really was state-sponsored that the gay family was an outlaw from society. So to be growing up inside that was hard.
And you still saw your father quite a bit at weekends, and you had one thing you all loved doing together, didn't you?
We spent a lot of time going to gardens with him. That was his passion, and that was the way that he chose to entertain my sister and me. And we loved going to the tea shop, we loved buying stickers, but over time I think we became more and more entranced by gardens themselves as a space to play in, as a beautiful space, and we really had this sort of grand education in English gardens.
Was music part of your early life?
Music saturated the house that I grew up in. My mother is passionate about opera. She's now an usher at Snape, which I think would have been her dream job all along. She loves romantic opera in particular. So our childhood home was full of Norma and Lucia de Lammermoor, very dramatic, passionate music, Il Trovatore, La Traviata, lots of Mozart. And there was a mood of emotional intensity that increasingly, her partner was an alcoholic, became sort of the environment of my growing up.
So Maria Callas epitomised this.
It was a very much Maria Callas household, yes.
We're going to hear her in Tosca singing Visi d'arte, I lived for art. Was this something that would crop up on the family gramophone?
It was absolutely played on the family gramophone, and I love Maria Callas, and I think this song has really been a thread through my life because I love the sentiment of it, I love the drama of it. Many of the writers or artists I've been drawn to working on also were passionate about Callas, so it feels very foundational to me, this one.
Some people find Puccini sentimental, but he was a master of the theatre.
And it is sentimental, and I think she goes to the furthest extreme with that, but there's a rigour to her as well. She's not sloppy, ever. And it's that kind of discipline and feeling together that I love so much about her voice.
This is a live recording from Paris in 1958.
And this is a tricky year for Callas. So 1958 is the year where she's been cancelling performances. She started developing this reputation both as a diva and as somebody whose voice is potentially failing. You can watch this recording on YouTube. You can see beautiful, slender Callas emoting. And to my mind, the slight broken quality adds to the power of her voice and the power of the performance. Full applause.
We heard Maria Callas in Paris in 1958 with Visi d'Arte from Puccini's Tosca, the Paris Opera Orchestra conducted by Georges Sébastien. Was writing, Olivia, something you always wanted to do?
Yes, I loved studying English. I loved reading. And I think as things got more difficult with my family, reading was really the refuge. That was where I put myself. It was almost a way of turning off the outside world and living inside books.
Well, you must have had some sort of gift because you got a place to study English at Sussex University, but then you didn't go, did you? Why?
Well, no, I got a place to do English at Cambridge, but I turned that down flat out because I wanted to go to Sussex to do theory. Sussex seemed like the sort of exciting and edgy place. And I went for 3 terms, but by that time, I'd got so caught up in environmental activism that it increasingly felt like my life was elsewhere. So there was this real sort of turnabout from being this very bookish, very shy child to growing up and becoming a teenager who was very politically engaged and very passionate about the environment and nature.
How did your parents react to this decision to not go to Cambridge? I mean, did it fit in with you being a bit au contraire?
I think by that point they'd sort of not washed their hands of me, but given up trying to influence any of my decisions. And they were very good about it. They'd come and visit me on road protests, tentatively come down and see all these dreadlocked people and be slightly horrified. But also I think they were proud and I think they were excited by it. It was an interesting world. And I'm sure that they worried very deeply about whether I'd get an education and what would happen. But I think they also trusted me that I knew what I was doing. And I was unstoppable anyway. There was no way they were going to convince me.
But you were getting an education. So I think this is the important thing about life, that everything is an education.
And every bit of the strange path I've taken has fed into the writing that I've done subsequently. I think the whole strange route that I took has really paid off. And by the time I did come back to a more traditional life, I had experiences that none of my peers had. They'd gone straight down the line of Cambridge and work experience and London jobs. And I'd had a much broader experience of life and political life and people.
What was living in that treehouse on a road protest near Weymouth like?
It was wonderful. I had a treehouse in a beech tree. It was a formidable climb to get into it. I had to wear a climbing harness. I'd abseil out in the morning on my ab line, which was spectacularly fun. It had a wood burner. It had a lovely actual bed, a camping bed, which was a great luxury. And there was an enormous net in the tree canopy, so we could loll around in this net. So there was a really beautiful side to it. But the other side was that these woodlands during this vast expansion of road building in the John Major government, the early 90s, were being cut down. This is the time of Newbury and Fairmile. And it was devastating. We were trying to make arguments about the climate that now are understood. Again, that's pervasive. But at the time, it was real outlier opinions. And it was a difficult life and it was a lonely life, too.
You then spent the winter on an abandoned pig farm outside Brighton, making your own home.
Well, that was a strange time, really. I had really dropped out and there were ways in which it was wonderful. It was very close to nature. I was living in a bender, which is basically a giant upturned basket made of hazel that you can live inside, covered with a tarpaulin. And waking up in the morning, you're living at ground level. There's no one else around. And I'd come out and be face to face with a deer. And it was extraordinary to have that sort of closeness. But it was extremely isolated. And I think in some ways, looking back, I was probably having some sort of post-protest breakdown, a kind of burnout that I think happens to a lot of people.
I got the impression, and it's something I kind of can connect with from my own experiences, that isolation fed into becoming a creative person.
I think that is very accurate, actually. I think that there's always a sense, why would you make anything if you could be completely understood? There's some sense that you can't quite communicate that makes you find this elaborate and complex medium with which you want to express yourself. And I think that sense of almost feeling that I couldn't communicate drove the return to writing. And that was a time, even living in the Bender, that was a time where I was writing a lot. It wasn't good, but the drive had returned in me.
You were very alone. Did you ever get scared?
I slept with an axe under my pillow. And mice would run across my face regularly in the night.
Let's hear a little bit about the next track, and the title of which certainly couldn't apply to you, being boring.
Michael. So this is perhaps set slightly earlier in my life. This is from the 90s, and it's really that period where I was living with my mum and my sister. Her relationship had ended and we were on an estate outside Portsmouth and the AIDS crisis was happening all around us. Kitty, who's a couple of years younger than me, had got very obsessed with Derek Jarman. My mum's closest friend worked at an AIDS clinic. Obviously, we were going to gay prides and I love the Pet Shop Boys. The Pet Shop Boys are one of my favourite bands. They epitomise the 80s and early 90s with their sort of synth pop sound. But this song is an elegy about AIDS and about queerness. And it really conveys both the grandness and the small, personal, intimate tragedy that that was for so many thousands of people.
Once said with quotations from
think that's the only use of the word haversack in a pop song.
Yes, well, it's certainly the only pop song called Being Boring, which of course it isn't, because both Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe have an extraordinary curiosity, don't they, about the world we live in.
Absolutely, and they have this amazing capacity to convey this sort of joyous, ecstatic musicality at the same time as this melancholy and irony and sorrow. And I think it's the tension between those two poles that's so moving. And that song, with its lines about the missing, is very much about AIDS, but it's also about how you transform yourself, how you go from being the odd child that you are into the artist or the human that you want to be. And that line about, I never thought I'd get to be the creature that I was meant to be, I find it so moving that art allows that transition to happen.
We heard Being Boring by the Pet Shop Boys from their 1990 album, Behaviour. Talking of your behaviour, Olivia Lang, you did decide to go back to university, and what did you study?
Well, I decided to train to be a herbalist. It was a 5-year, basically a medicine degree, and for the rest of my life, people thought that I'd done a weekend course as a homeopath.
So you were virtually a doctor?
Virtually a doctor. I studied anatomy and physiology. I studied biochemistry. It was a very, very intensive training. And it was a fascinating training because it was about the body in sickness and in health, but it was also about plants and how plants can be utilised. And possibly most important of all, because it taught me how to take a case history, because I had to do my 500 clinical hours and then because I practised, it really trained me to do interviews, to elicit information from a subject on a deep level. So I think it was a useful course in the end.
Did you have people referred to you who perhaps weren't getting anywhere with conventional
yes.
therapy?
Yes. The people I would see were often terminally ill, or they had the kind of diagnoses that weren't going to be treated by conventional medicine, ME, problems around the menopause, things that are really resistant to treatment. And I found it extremely frustrating because it's a very isolated way of practicing medicine. And I think as I went on, I felt more and more like there should be much more cross discussion between the NHS and alternative practitioners. That was the sort of ideal that I wanted. And I think also I was realising that it really wasn't the right path for me. I'd gone down the wrong road. But at the same time, I very much wanted to finish it. And I practiced for another 3 or 4 years in Brighton.
Because so many conditions are caused to a degree or exacerbated by anxiety.
Absolutely. And when I came to write Everybody, which is the book before the Garden book, which is really about bodies, it was drawing on the ideas of Wilhelm Reich, the Austrian-born psychoanalyst. And he thought that our entire emotional lives, everything traumatic that's happened to us in childhood, every prohibition, every fear, locks into our bodies. And I think that idea still feels very fertile to me, that we hold a lot of our past experiences inside our bodies and it manifests as anxiety or as depression. But also anxiety and depression manifest in physical ways, that there's this incredibly interesting cross traffic between our minds, our spirits and our bodies.
We're going to go now to Wagner and Tristan und Isolde.
This was such a turning point in my life, having had all of these wilderness years that we've discussed in such detail, such mortifying detail. I was in a relationship actually with the same person who played the Bach, and he was a huge Wagner fan and loved Tristan, and he played this to me. And I think this is really a moment where I really realised I was on the wrong track. I didn't want to be living the life I was living. I wanted to write, I wanted to be an artist, and I was ripe to have this Wagnerian moment.
His music really is sensuous, isn't it?
You can't get more sensuous. And then at the same time, there's the dissolving into nothing, all the time threatened, the dissolving into nothing.
Those long lines, which both Strauss and Wagner achieved, they do have a kind of physicality, don't they?
It's incredibly physical. I mean, it's orgasmic, it's a shattering, it's the movement of the sea. It has this intense physical effect. It's so sublime.
He takes, you know, in that wonderful Paul Klee quote, takes a line for a walk.
Mm.
But he takes it for a marathon.
He takes it on a long journey. And he sets up the tension and he keeps it moving. And then I think so much of my interest in music is to do with those sort of making of structures, making of complex structures, moving emotion, moving coloration around, that's what's transferable to thinking about writing.
We heard the conclusion of Tristan and Isolde by Wagner, performed by Birgit Nielsen and the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra, conducted by Karl Böhm. Once you'd made the decision, Olivia, to become a writer, how long did it take before you felt you could actually call yourself one?
Oh, God, 20 years? I'm still a bit embarrassed about saying it.
Your first book, The River, A Journey Beneath the Surface, was published in 2011, and it explored the River Ouse and the life of Virginia Woolf. What brought you to those two things?
I was living still in Brighton, and I loved that valley. I loved the Ouse Valley. And I think I never would have written it, except that I'd been working at The Observer as the deputy literary editor, and I got made redundant in that first big round of redundancies after the crash. And I was absolutely devastated. I felt like I'd got myself into the world I wanted to be and was holding on by my fingernails and then was sort of thrust out. And it was really terrifying. And the literary editor of The Guardian at the time, Claire Armitstead, said to me, there's a very small window in a woman's life where you can write a book. Take it. She really sort of took me by the shoulders and said it to me in a corridor in The Guardian. And I thought, OK, well, this is perhaps an opportunity. And I have this idea and I'll write a book proposal and see what happens. And that sort of, well, I'll see what happens. I'll see how long I can keep this going. Really has continued. That's the line still going for the walk.
Your books often begin with the personal and then go on a quest. The second book was another journey, this time across America, which examined the tricky relationship between creativity and alcohol.
And that came from a very personal place. As I said earlier, my mother's partner was an alcoholic and I grew up in an alcoholic family, which is a frightening place to live. It's frightening because of the disorder and chaos, and it's also frightening because of the prohibition, the secrecy around it, and having to live like that alongside a closeted family. I think that sort of double layer of silence was very formative to me, the desire to break that and to be frank, but also the sense of shame around secrecy stayed with me. And I wanted to make it clear when I was writing that book that it wasn't just an academic study of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Tennessee Williams, that I really had skin in the game. I wanted to understand what it meant to drink. I wanted to understand what it meant to get sober. I wanted to look at these people's lives very deeply, look at their work, see how those things had fed into each other.
Talking of disciplined way of working, do you have a ritual to your writing?
I always write listening to the same piece of music. And I am ritualised.
Well, you went to school with nuns, didn't you?
I went to school with nuns. I'm very ritualised, right? I think that's part of why I like the Pet Shop Boys. It's the Catholic education. Mm. So they have a structure, a skeleton that starts out. And then I do very deep research. I do lots of archival work. Then I write in an extremely intense long hours way for a year or two.
Brian Eno next.
Watch my fingers start to type. Brian Eno is really the thing that I listen to. This track is what I have written basically all seven books to. I don't know whether Brian Eno would be pleased by that or dismayed.
I think he'd be thrilled.
Thank you.
the opening of Ambient One, Music for Airports, composed and performed by Brian Eno.
It's such a lovely piece of music, because it has that sort of melancholy feeling that I respond to very deeply, but also it's very spacious and it creates room for thought. I think that's what's so fantastic about Eno's music. There's nothing vacuous about it. There isn't a vacuum there. It's thoughtful, it's curious music. And it's very stimulating for me to be able to think alongside. Lots of music is just rhythmically wrong because when I'm writing, I mutter the whole time. I have to get the rhythms right. And I sound like Glenn Gould. I didn't know this until I moved in with my husband. And then he said, "What are you doing all the time?" And I think that sense of having a rhythm in your head is very important, and music can often interfere with it. But somehow the Brian Eno allows that kind of counterpoint of your own work.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the writer Olivia Lang. You went, Olivia, to live in New York in your mid-30s. What was the draw of New York?
It seems funny, doesn't it, after all this talk of wild spaces and very close to nature living, but the other side of me wanted very much to live somewhere that was urban. I find New York very, very beautiful, and it runs at a speed that I felt immediately at home in. And at the same time, I had quite a difficult time there.
Because you were lonely?
Because I was lonely. A relationship had just ended. I found myself abruptly untethered at a strange age. Mid-30s, I think, is an odd time because lots of my friends were settling down, having families in conventional jobs. And moving to America, I found myself in a different world. Most of my community was gay and involved in the art world. And suddenly I was in this sort of different kind of way of being that I loved. But I think it took me a good couple of years to find my feet. And during that time, I was very lonely.
Was writing something to sort of sink yourself into?
Yes, and I think it's curiosity again. I wasn't very happy personally, but the writer in me almost immediately recognised that what I was feeling was taboo, that people didn't talk about it, people didn't write about it. It was unexamined territory, and that was tremendously exciting. I didn't feel good as me, but in terms of the subject matter that had suddenly been handed to me, I realised that there was this mysterious continent of human experience. And the more delving I did, I found this sort of collection of American artists who explored loneliness from different aspects in their work.
Edward Hopper, Warhol.
The great visionary poet of loneliness. Warhol, this very sociable person who's also very isolated.
But you've touched on something interesting there, because loneliness is not simply one person shut in a room. You can be very lonely and be in a huge social ambience, can't you?
Absolutely. You can be lonely in a marriage. You can be lonely at a party. You can be lonely for political reasons. Loneliness runs through our societies. The homeless are lonely. Refugees are lonely. That sense that people are othered and pushed to the margins is a lonely experience.
Yes, I suppose in a strange way, the more a city is thriving and lively, the more lonely you can feel.
And New York is the epitome of that, because it's a city of windows. This is what Hopper conveys, I think, in his paintings, this sense that you are trapped behind glass, you can see other people, you can see this visual experience of people having social, convivial lives, and you're stuck alone. And I think it really magnifies the experience, or it did for me. And at the same time, it's a city of encounters. And I felt like the more I travelled into the artworks, the more I encountered these extraordinary people who did make me feel less alone, because I realised how non-unusual my experience was.
And this leads us to the countertenor, Klaus Nomi.
An extraordinary figure from downtown New York. I was living in the East Village, and Nomi had lived in exactly that little network of streets. He was German originally. He was a performer with this superb operatic voice at a time when the countertenor was very unfashionable. He wanted to work in opera and he couldn't. So he ended up creating this sort of extraordinary, not quite pop star, not quite avant-garde performer, somewhere in between. And as he was starting to become famous, putting out records, working with Bowie, he started to develop lesions on his face. He started to become ill, and this was what was initially known as GRID and then became known as AIDS. He was one of the very first people to die of AIDS.
And the piece you've chosen?
It's Purcell, because he had this ability to pull things from the classical repertoire as well as singing his own very strange and idiosyncratic pop songs. And there's an extraordinary video on YouTube of him dressed almost in 16th century clothes, these black tights and strange shoes, and he's wearing a ruff. And the reason he was wearing the ruff is because he had Kaposi sarcoma all across his neck, but his face is powdered. He looks like he's stepped, well, it's the Song of the Cold Genius, he looks like he's stepped from both Purcell's stage and from the other world. It's quite literally chilling.
It's very moving, isn't it? The way that voice goes up from a lower tessitura into the countertenor, and it sounds almost desperate.
It's almost this sort of invocation of death, that let me at the end, this sort of desire to be released, desire not to be released, and almost hard to listen to.
Extraordinary too, because the Purcell accompaniment is obviously not as Purcell would have heard it, but it works in this context.
Yeah, and it holds it in this sort of frosty hinterland. It feels very unearthly to listen to that. His voice is very unearthly. Whatever he's singing, even if he's singing, you know, lightning strikes, he sounds like he's come from another planet. And there's something, well, he kind of epitomises that loneliness. He's one of a kind, and the longing but the refusal to be the same is very moving to me.
What Power Thou Art from Purcell's King Arthur, reimagined and performed by Klaus Nomi as the cold song on his 1981 album Klaus Nomi. New York is also actually the subject of your next piece of music, Olivia.
It is, and it's very deeply associated with 9/11, William Basinski, Disintegration Loops.
What he does here is, I think, very fascinating. He actually makes something out of disintegration.
It's really extraordinary. What he had done is recorded these little loops of music in the 1980s from just radio stations, and he came back to them, and decades later, he realised as he was playing them that the actual tape is flaking off, and he put them on a loop. So what happens with disintegration loops? It's an hour long, and it starts with a repetitive tune that gradually, but almost so that you don't notice it, falls apart until there's really nothing left. And the extraordinary thing about this piece of music is Basinski finished it just before 9/11, and his apartment overlooked the buildings. So he went up onto his roof and he filmed the smoking towers and put this film to this piece of music. And it's become almost the official music of 9/11. It was played at the memorial. It's deeply associated in New Yorkers' consciousness with what happened that day. But I think it's also music about deterioration and endurance, because this loop has this sort of beautiful, heartening trumpet in it. And as it falls away, that's almost all that's left, this feeling of human endeavour against the odds. And again, it's a piece of music I find very moving. Before I left this morning, I listened to the very end of it, and it makes absolutely no sense. It's like reading the last page of a Henry James novel. You have to travel through the whole journey and feel it fall away. Otherwise, it's just a random piece of music.
Yes, but even that little bit has a kind of earworm quality, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you find yourself thinking inside it.
Your book, Everybody, is about the struggle for bodily freedom. In that book, you talk about the civil rights activist and musician Nina Simone.
Nina Simone is a very key character in that book. She comes right at the end of it. She was the soul of the civil rights movement. I think people found her music so sustaining that she took people through these repertoires of rage and fury, that she really gives voice to that, and then she lifts them up and out of it. Her performances are so cathartic. And she's making this song at a time of real personal difficulty. She's left what she's calling the United Snakes of America. She's living in Barbados and her marriage has broken up. But more than that, it's a very bleak period for the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King has been killed a few years earlier. Friend after friend has died in that struggle. And this song gives voice to her fury, that sort of preacher aspect of her that desires retribution. But it also conveys a sort of radical freedom. I don't think there's anything else like it. It's an absolutely amazing song.
There is no oxygen in the air. Men and women have lost their hair. Ashen faces, legs that tomorrow will be the 22nd century. It will be. When the 20th century was at an end, 1990 was the year when the plague struck the earth. 1988 was the year when men and women struck out for freedom and bloodletting was the thing that was. Liberation of men, everybody carrying a heavy load. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. It will be. Love and life, sex, changing, changing, changing.
woman is a man, even your brain is not your brain. Your heart is a plastic thing that can be bought. There are no more diseases that can be caught. Man became the thing that he worshipped. Man truly became his God. That was the day that man and woman truly became born. Man became his good, man became his evil, man became his God, and man became his devil. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. It will be. It will be. Falling in love, give that lady fair diamond ring. Wedding, 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 wedding. You know a wedding ain't the thing. Don't want no preacher, don't want no preacher man preaching. Give me your hand and take my hand. This is better than anybody's preacher man. Yeah, the truth. Century. Tomorrow will be the 22nd century. It will be. It will be. It will be.
It's spine tingling. There's a bit towards the end where she's singing, your day will go away. And you just feel all her despair, all her fury, galvanizing into this dream of freedom that's almost terrifying. It's apocalyptic, and yet you can't help but respond to the vision that she's unlaying for you.
22nd century, originally by Bohemian musician Exuma, rearranged and performed there by Nina Simone with the conductor Harold Wheeler for her 71 album Here Comes the Sun. Olivia Lang, you married the poet Ian Paterson in 2017. How did you first meet?
We first met on Twitter, and I was living in New York. And then when I moved to Cambridge, it turned out that we both really liked gardens. So I came to visit his garden, he came to visit mine. And it was the beginning of a really lovely friendship. And I lived very close to him and his then wife, Jenny Diskey. And when Jenny got ill, Ian would, on the way to Waitrose, pop in, cry for 20 minutes, leave. And I think that was enough for him to keep going with the sort of extraordinary responsibility of being a carer for somebody you love who's terminally ill.
You've described him as the best thing that happened to you. But how difficult was it to get close to someone, let alone live with them, after so many years living on your own?
It was extremely and excruciatingly hard, and I don't think I've cracked it yet, but I'm definitely better at it after the crash course of the pandemic.
And your next piece of music, he is passionate about.
He is absolutely obsessed with Handel, and his study is underneath my study. So he's carried out an indoctrination campaign for the last few years. But I always loved this. This was played at our wedding. My friend Joseph Keckler, who is an extraordinary opera performer, sang this at our wedding. And it, it's probably going to make me cry.
Ombra, My Fool, from Handel's opera Circe, performed by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Harry Bickett.
It's so emotionally far from where we started, the sort of Maria Callas romantic opera, high drama, high feeling, and yet there's so much emotion contained in it. And I think that's one of the things that Ian has really meant for me, is this house of calmness, the sort of very scholarly, not at all dry, but much subtler and more ambiguous emotional range.
So sometimes less is more.
Less is more, and I think living with somebody who's like that is very grounding.
You and Ian moved to a Georgian house in Suffolk in lockdown, and your latest book, and it's a wonderful book, I must say, is all about your efforts to restore the gardens there. And it had actually been owned by a garden designer, hadn't it?
It had been owned by Mark Roomery, who was the head designer at Knockcuts in the 1960s. He trained with Lanning Roper, and he was a really terrifically good gardener. He won the Lawrence Medal several times, and he was very well known for his displays at Chelsea, and he made all sorts of gardens across Suffolk, but also across the world.
But the book's also an examination of the search for paradise. I was particularly struck by the poet John Clare and how he built a garden to sustain him.
This is a really heartbreaking story. The peasant poet John Clare, the poet of the enclosures, he was a member of the lowest tier of the rural working class, who were disenfranchised and dispossessed by the enclosures. And he wrote that all down. He described what it was like to see the loved landscape carved up, transformed for the purposes of profit. And I think in some ways he's our first ecological poet. He saw nature as a continuum, and he saw the ways that that kind of work was destroying it in ways that we're now seeing with climate change. But his gardening is very interesting, because what he felt compelled, I think, to do was to gather up plants from wild places and place them in his own garden in exactly the same way that he gathers up folk names of plants and places them in his poems. He makes these sort of spaces of refuge. And he was an exceptional botanist. The record that he's left of plants described and given their Fenland folk names is hundreds long, and they can all be recognised by botanists and identified now.
One of the things I love about your writing is that you tease out things, like, for example, the origin of the word paradise, which is Persian.
Absolutely. And I thought paradise is heaven first and has an association with gardens because of the Garden of Eden. But actually, it's the other way around. Paradise means a walled garden. And it interested me so much that our deepest desire as a species is this place of abundance and beauty and safety.
And you talk about the complex history of the grand gardens that Britain is known for, but how so many were financed by the slave trade.
And that's one of the really shocking things that I discovered as I was writing it. I focused on a Suffolk family called the Middletons, who made their money in the transatlantic slave trade, went to South Carolina, had rice plantations, built these huge fortunes, and then almost used gardens as a way of laundering their money in order to move up the echelons of society. And by the end, they've got Prince Albert coming to visit their garden. So a family that make their money out of the most repellent means possible, then produce this version of themselves that is illutriated, that's purified, and that I really wanted to take apart.
You clearly love what we might call orchestrating the garden, working out which plant should go where.
Absolutely, and it's the pleasure of writing too. It's the pleasure of creating a formal structure and then tinkering with it. And the thing that's nice about a garden is it's always pushing back. It's always responding to you. When you're writing, you can do anything, and that freedom, I think, can sometimes be intimidating. But when you're gardening, you're a conductor of quite a rebellious orchestra.
So you were, as it were, laid in earth.
I was laid in earth, and I enjoyed it.
And that takes us nicely to Dido and Aeneas, your final track.
I've realised as we've been listening that there are a lot of death songs in this selection that I've produced. And I think this kind of music, my last beautiful statement before I leave, is something that I find very moving. And this is surely one of the most beautiful last statements. Dido's Lament, sung by Janet Baker, is rapturously beautiful. And it has a simplicity about it, that sort of Purcellian simplicity about living your life and then relinquishing. And I think it's the relinquishing, the humility of it, that I find very moving.
Olivia Lang, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When I Am Laid in Earth from Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell, performed by Janet Baker and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Lewis. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the writer Olivia Lang. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the food writer and campaigner, Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall.
Do you love jokes?
She likes jokes. I'm the joke guy.
Do you find things funny?
I can tell that by looking at you.
Have you ever laughed?
I'm glad you find this amusing.
If you said yes to any of the above, BBC Sounds has got you covered.
What are you thinking?
There's Frank Skinner's One Person Found This Helpful.
A show where we look at online reviews.
Paul Merton's Room 101.
I don't like cows.
You don't like cows?
They seem to be everywhere.
And No Such Thing as a Fish.
He just didn't want to wear socks anymore.
What a legend.
Find your next comedy favourite. Listen on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3 on this Sunday afternoon with me, Jane Royce. It's 1:30 now and time to join Sarah Moore-Peach for today's musical journey, a special selection of music to mark Midsummer.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the programme where we take a single piece of music and listen all around it, forwards, backwards, sideways in time and space, mapping out a sonic landscape as we travel towards our destination. And today, we're heading into the forest. This is Felix Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream Overture, music full of character and effect, inspired by Shakespeare's comedy that takes place in the Athenian forest on the eve of a wedding, in the company of royals, workmen, and fairies. Mendelssohn wrote this overture when he was just 17, and it is a standalone piece. It's separate to the incidental music for the play, with its famous wedding march, which he wrote a lot later. But Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream had a hold on Mendelssohn's imagination his entire life, and over the course of today's show, we'll hear other music inspired by the same play, of which there's a lot, as well as some traditional midsummer tunes. But let's begin with another comedy set against the backdrop of a wedding celebration. This time, the scurrying feet are not fairies, but servants.